Welcome to another edition of Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones, your host for today's show. In this episode, our guests are a group of 7th and 8th grade students from Portland's Cottonwood School of Civics and Science and their humanities teacher, Emily Connor. The students recently completed podcasts on the topic Globalization and Food and entered them in the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. The winners will be announced later this month. We're fortunate to have Emily and three of those podcast groups here to tell us more about the project and their work. Thank you all for coming into KBOO today. And Emily, let's start with you. You and Chris Weiland are the teachers for the group. On the Cottonwood School website, it mentions students learning about globalization in the 7th and 8th grades and visit local businesses to see how global trade impacts Portland.
Yeah.
How did you and Chris decide to turn this into a podcast project for the class?
So there are a lot of things that go into our project planning, and a lot of it is our experience and serendipity. And we had heard from, I think it was a parent told us about the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. So once we heard about that contest, we decided that we would sort of point our project in the direction of like an opportunity that's already out there to give students sort of an authentic goal so that they can, you know, have an incentive beyond just our classroom.
Beyond just learning, they're producing something pretty valuable there. Yeah. What are the qualifications for that NPR Student Podcast Challenge?
Like the guidelines or?
The guidelines. I know the podcasts need to be about 3 to 12 minutes in length.
About 3 to 12 minutes in length. They cannot have music, so that was a really hard one for our students. They wanted to produce their own music and put it into the podcasts, but NPR set the rule that you can't have music so that there are no copyright issues and all.
That's probably smart.
And they should be student-produced and student-created. It was pretty open guidelines.
So have the students created podcasts before in the class?
These particular students haven't. We did a podcast project 2 years ago. Similar topic, globalization, but for that project, they looked at how a local business has a global connection, so it was a little bit more open. And those podcasts were just played within the classroom and shared with the community, so there wasn't a bigger audience for those.
So these groups of students, then, how did you ramp them up on how to create a podcast? Boy, there's a lot involved. There's writing, recording, editing.
Yeah, and we got a lot of help from members of our community and experts. For instance, you came into the classroom and helped the students with editing and showed them some techniques and gave them some tips.
So you had a few people who weren't experts.
Yes. No, everybody was an amazing help.
You had a woman from a food podcast, right? The Bite?
Yeah, Maddie Oatman from The Bite podcast, which is Mother Jones' food podcast, spoke to our students over Skype, and she talked about interviewing and capturing room tone and getting good sound recordings. We also had guests in our classroom, Mikey Nielsen and Alan Barsh, who have a podcast, Chronicles of the Nerds, I think is what it's called. And they talked about creating a script and also using a mic and having good interview skills.
I've listened to three of them, and we'll be talking to them today, too. And it's just amazing what they came up with.
They're incredible.
Yeah. I mentioned this when I went to the class too and presented that the cool thing and probably the most unique thing about podcasts is you're telling the story entirely in sound. You have nothing else to go by.
Yeah.
Was that a strange concept for the students? A lot of young people, a lot of us, in fact, of any age are more used to video these days, books, graphic novels.
Yeah, I think that's true, but also it didn't seem that strange to them. They immediately rose to the challenge and they were really great about capturing room tone, about going around and getting really interesting audio. I think because they have listened to so much radio and so many of them are familiar with podcasts, it was a familiar concept. And yeah, they seem to be naturals.
Did they have some favorites that you used as examples in the class, in addition to The Bite, of course?
I'm not sure.
Maybe everybody has their own set.
Yeah, we listened to a number of food podcasts, and then I encouraged them to listen to ones on their own to just get a feel for like different styles and different ways of telling stories through
audio. And there's no shortage. There's, I read there's somewhere over 500 million, half a billion, is it? Half a million.
Okay.
Half a million, yeah. Approaching 1 million podcasts.
Wow.
Though I think it's closer to 1 billion, but from what I'm seeing on iTunes. Now, you divided the students into groups, mm-hmm. and we've got three of them here today. How did you divide them and assign roles? There's producer, writer, host, researcher, editor.
Yeah. So as we were listening to podcasts and developing the project, we had students come up with a list of skills that it would take to make a really good podcast. And with those skills, we created a survey. So we asked students, rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 or something like that. On how comfortable you are with these skills. So editing, conducting interviews, writing, researching. And based on their surveys, we put them in groups with people who had different skill sets.
Oh, okay. So playing to their interests and their skills.
Yeah. And some had a really firm idea of what they wanted to do their podcasts on. So we also tried to group them according to the topics that they were interested in.
Now, the Cottonwood website mentions that you apply the lenses of social justice and eco-justice to all units of study, definitely evident in these podcasts that I listen to.
Mm-hmm.
How do you introduce those concepts to the students? Maybe it comes naturally to them. That'd be great if it did.
I think because they have been experiencing these concepts throughout their time at our school, that they're, I think, pretty fully integrated into the units that we create.
And you start with kindergarten there, and some of the students have been there for, 7 or 8 years?
A few of the students have been there since kindergarten, many since second or third grade. So I think they're just accustomed to it at this point.
Now, in addition to learning a lot about what we eat and how it affects us personally and our environment, which we see in the podcast, or listen to and hear in the podcast, what do you think the students gleaned from doing those projects?
I think a big thing that they worked on this for this project was working in groups. They were put in groups with students who they'd never worked with before, many of them. So they had to do a lot of problem solving, a lot of figuring out who's going to do what and how to help a group member who may not know what to do, how to get the best out of each classmate, how to encourage each other, how to recognize different styles of leadership and learning abilities. So group work was huge for this.
Oh, Emily, thank you.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's good to talk to you.
Let's get to our first group of Cottonwood students, the creators of the podcast Con Leche. Could we go around first and have you all introduce yourselves, starting with you, Soren?
Yeah, my name's Soren.
My name is Jake.
My name's Naomi.
I'm Aurora.
Oh, thanks. And Soren, can you tell us a little bit about the Con Leche Coffee Shop, which is the subject of your podcast, and why you chose this business for the project?
Yeah, so Con Leche is a Mexican coffee shop located in the South Waterfront area, and we chose it because we thought it would have a good and rich culture, I would say. It was a really interesting interview. There were a lot of things that I learned, and when we were first picking out our topic, we had Mr. Greenbeans come in, who is one of our classmates' parents, and he is a coffee bean distributor.
He wasn't in the podcast itself, but he helped set this up.
Exactly, yeah, and so he gave us all the contact information, and he, you know, told us about what they do at Con Leche, and so we thought, well, yeah, that would be a great place to do an interview. So yeah.
Now the people who are in it, well one in particular, the owners are Angel and Lucy Medina.
Yes.
And you interview Angel in there. You went about getting his okay through your classmate's dad and Mr. Greenbeans.
He gave us the contact information, and then I emailed him asking him if we could go over there and do an interview. And,
oh, great.
Yeah.
How did you as a group prepare the questions for him?
Well, I mean, we wrote some questions out, and then they thought, you know, you guys thought about some, you know, interesting topic questions, I guess.
We'll play a little bit for our listeners, but at the start of the podcast, what struck me as kind of an expert move here by your group is you describe the smells of the shop.
Yeah.
Walking in there, which really puts the listener right there. I mean, it's a great way to tell a story through sound, through audio. Was this something you got from studying other podcasts or just came natural?
I think it came kind of natural. It's definitely, you know, when I walk into a coffee shop, I smell coffee. That's why. But when
and this
when,
is a little more unique.
Yeah, this is definitely more unique because, you know, they have like flowers everywhere, which is what we talk about in the right. podcast. And so it's definitely a different. So, it's, you know, kind of cool to tell the listeners about that. So.
And then later on, you describe one of their featured items, which is a Mexican coffee with a very strong scent of cinnamon. And also it has sugar in there.
Yeah.
Another interesting part of the podcast, you and Angel talked about Con Leche's support of organizations such as United We Dream. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That's more kind of the eco-justice and the social justice aspects of the podcast.
Yeah, and so when I was doing research on the coffee shop, I did some research before. I don't specifically know much about United We Dream, but I did notice that before they started their coffee shop, or like they were associated with it, I think is what Angel said. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I think it supports, you know, immigrants and
I looked it up. It's the largest, and I'd never heard of it before, Soren. It's the largest immigrant youth-led community in the U.S. So they actually sponsor and organize campaigns at the local, state, and federal level.
So I had never heard of it either. So you know, it was cool to learn a bit about it.
Let me open this up for the group. What did you learn about podcasting from the project? And do any of you plan to continue maybe doing another podcast?
Well, we found like stuff from other podcasts that we thought we would use. Like, I don't know, they use sound from different podcasts, and we found that very interesting, so we thought we would use that.
Oh, yeah, and you do a good job of that. We're kind of right there in with you at the Con Leche Coffee Shop. Well, again, thank you all. Soren, Naomi, Aurora, and Jake, thanks very much for coming into KBOO, and thanks for giving us that wonderful Con Leche podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Definitely. Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, I am Soren, and today we're talking about Mexican coffee and how it's different from the regular coffee we are used to. We got to go down to Con Leche, a Mexican coffee shop in Portland, Oregon, in the South Waterfront. When you walk in, the place smells like coffee, but it also smells floral because of these flower bouquets throughout the store. I had the chance to interview Angel Medina, who owns Con Leche, with his wife Lucy Medina.
So what inspired you to start your business?
The need to do something for a different group of people that were disenfranchised, in this case, DACA recipients. So I started roasting coffee long ago as a hobby, and I began selling it to my friends after 2 years of me doing it at home, in exchange for them donating $10 to a nonprofit called United We Dream, which supports undocumented youth who were brought here when they were 4 or 5, or even younger than that, and that's how the whole thing came about.
To sum up the nonprofit he's talking about, United We Dream is the largest immigrant youth-led community in the U.S. It primarily focuses on immigrants, but also supports LGBTQ+ and women. In Mexico, coffee is usually brewed with cinnamon and sugar. The cinnamon and sugar aren't just added to the coffee after brewing, but are incorporated right into the brewing technique. The cinnamon and sugar make the coffee sweet and spicy.
What is special about the coffee that you sell here?
The way that we do it, and most companies do it this way, right? We have the power to reach out to a farmer, for example, in Mexico. We buy a lot of coffee from Mexico, and we have direct relationships to do that. So that means that somewhere in some farm in Colima, Mexico, or Oaxaca, Mexico, or Veracruz, there's an entire family that's been doing it longer than we have, that's cultivating, that's picking cherries, that's drying them, processing them, washing them, setting, and figuring out that whole process of getting them from their warehouse to a truck to a boat to a warehouse, and a warehouse to us. So when you think about all the steps that it goes through, mm-hmm. and how many hands it touches, and all the things that could go right, and all the things that could go wrong, it's kind of an awesome process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then we talked a bit about money and how that plays an important role in the coffee business.
Say, for example, the coffee that we're going to be selling in May and June, we have to pay for it, for the most part, January, February. Because you're buying all the good stuff that hasn't gotten here yet. And even if it's gotten here, you're roasting on a schedule long term. So you have to make all these purchases ahead. You don't necessarily have to pay for it right away, but a lot of it is just, those expenses. And then you know, that's just a coffee. When you look at the human resources part, there's staffing, right?
Yeah.
You want to keep your employees happy and make sure that they have enough hours, but you only have enough hours during your busiest times, between like April all the way to November. Mm-hmm. So somewhere between December, January, February, March, you have to figure out a way to continue and keep in as much as your staff you can employ, or figure out a way to find them better opportunities, whether it's inside a coffee or outside of it.
So there you go. That was everything we gathered about Mexican coffee. I hope you enjoyed listening, and I'd like to thank Angel Medina for letting us interview him and for sharing his experiences.
Our next group are the talented students behind the Candy Calamity podcast. First, could you all please introduce yourselves for our listeners? And Dylan, we'll start with you.
Hi, I'm Dylan.
I'm Silas.
I'm Andrew.
I'm Liv.
I'm Sophia.
I'm Nico. I didn't do much work.
Okay, Nico.
And I don't get to be interviewed much.
Well, we'll get you in here. Now, for the podcast, you guys chose a great premise. Take a food we all love and examine its impact on our environment. That food, of course, is candy. How did you come up with the topic?
It started out with, it was just like interviewing the kindergartners, because we would fill out this like little interview sheet to see what we wanted to do in our podcast, not exactly the topic, and we all wanted to do something with the kindergartners in our school. So it started out with that, and then we were like, oh, what's with the kindergartners? And since it needed to be involved with the environment and globalization, we chose just food.
Wow, you kind of lucked out there.
We thought, you know, food's a little too broad. That'll be really hard to research. So it eventually evolved into candy.
We're talking about research. Well, first, it was brilliant to interview the kindergartners because they're right there, right? You didn't have to leave the school. The research was really impressive in the podcast. You present data on how much candy the average American eats per year. And I was amazed to find out it's 24 pounds. Some of the kindergartens, what one of them said, 1 gram,
yeah.
which I think is just about 450 grams in a pound or something. So they were a little off.
Yeah. Well,
they underestimated.
It's one funny lick of a lollipop.
Dylan mentioned that in the podcast. It's funny.
And then you use data from the National Center for Biotechnology and the Plastic Pollution Coalition to calculate the negative effects this has on the environment. Very convincing argument in the podcast. Did you have a researcher in the group getting the data and doing the math?
Yeah, Silas was a researcher, and Sophia worked a lot on researching, too.
How'd you guys go about doing that, Silas, Sophia?
Well, I kind of mostly, I mean, I did do research, but I found mostly the source. I found lots of sources. I didn't do a ton of just thorough reading. I just found a lot of sources that then you can get more information from.
Well, it was great research. Sophia, did you work with Silas on that?
Yeah, I did work with Silas. I kind of just looked up the exact question that I had, and from there, I just looked through at different websites that I studied the websites to make sure that they were trustworthy and I could find good information. So I clicked on the one that I thought was best, and I just read through it.
And then the math there, you actually multiplied the average amount of candy eaten each year, the 24 pounds, by the number of Americans, and then came up with the environmental impacts based on the other data that you had.
Yeah.
So there was quite a bit of math involved.
Yeah.
Now, Dylan, let's get back to you. I love that you didn't stop there at showing the negative effects on the environment of the candy, but you gave us some positive steps for helping to reduce the damage. Can you give us a few of these that you guys came up with?
Yeah, one of them, it's complicated names, but like a more high technology irrigation system, because a lot of the waste is from the way the water is used, because like it's not used very efficiently, so either they use too much or there's so much that it just runs off into lakes and stuff. And another way is to have more recyclable materials as wrapping for candy
instead of plastic for the wrappers.
Yeah, it's
just plastic. You had a very sad statistic in there about the fish. Mm-hmm. Who swallow the plastic, and then, of course, that's toxic, and that enters our food supply because people eat fish and other animals eat the fish.
Yeah, yeah.
How would we reduce that then? Again, that's the recyclables for the wrappers?
Well, yeah, if the wrappers were more recyclable, maybe. We didn't research specifically how to prevent the plastic from getting into the water, but definitely.
But if you reduce the plastic, it doesn't get into the water,
yeah.
Or a lot less does. I found it a very persuasive case. Here's something that we eat every day and people mostly enjoy, candy. It has a negative impact on the environment, but there's ways of reducing the negative effects. Mm-hmm. So it was a very persuasive podcast. What did you learn about telling a story and making a persuasive argument through podcasting, through sound alone?
Well, you have to make sure that you're descriptive. Like, people can't, you can't be like, oh, well, sure, you can say where you got the information, but people are just going to listen to that, and maybe they won't be able to listen to it again, so you got to be able to put a small amount of information into one memorable sentence. Because I read once that you only remember about 10% of what you're hearing, so you got to make sure
yes.
it's easy to remember.
When people are listening to podcasts and the radio, especially when they're listening to me, they don't really pay that much attention.
Yeah.
So I've always learned it doesn't hurt to repeat mm-hmm. information throughout. But you guys did a great job. Again, thanks very much for coming into KBOO today.
Thanks, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dylan, and I'll be your host for today as we talk about the impact candy has on the environment.
Candy is a common occurrence in most people's lives. You eat it for holidays, birthdays, celebrations, desserts, or just when your sweet tooth kicks in.
Some people are healthy about how much candy they eat by not having too much and eating balanced meals. And some people aren't, giving in whenever the craving strikes and not caring about the sugar or calories.
The way candy impacts your health is usually the only negative thing that comes to mind when thinking about candy.
But there's so much more to it. Have you thought about how much candy is produced in a year? How much fuel it takes to power the trucks, boats, planes, and trains it takes to get that candy all over the world? Have you thought about how much candy wrappers are thrown away in a single day? And where does all that trash go?
I know I've brought up a lot of pressing questions, but let's take a step back and think about when it all started. When you were just a little kid begging your parents for that neon artificial flavor pack treat you just had to have. Or back when you were dressed up for Halloween, going door-to-door yelling, trick-or-treat, until your candy bag was filled to the brim.
That's when you learn about candy in all its glory. So, to learn about candy from the perspective of a young kid, we interviewed 5 of the kindergartners in our school. What's your favorite candy?
Cupcakes. Raspberry.
Ooh. Never heard of raspberry cupcakes before.
It's raspberry flavor with a raspberry on top. Cake with ice cream in it, ice cream cake, and has vanilla smoothie in it.
It is Sour Patch. All sour things in our candy.
All of them. My mom only lets me eat it, and Dad on the weekends.
It's very hard, but it is cake with donuts in it, with all the treats in it. Except some candies, which are too sour for me.
How much candy do you think you eat in a day?
Like 4 grams. Like what? 4 grams. One gram.
1 gram?
That's a lot. Of course, maybe 2 grams.
Sugar half a day.
Sugar half a day? What's that mean?
I eat sugar half a day. Lollipops.
So like one lollipop a day?
Yes. I mostly only eat candy on Halloween or on special occasions. That's mostly it. I only eat one piece of candy.
Now that we've learned a thing or two about the kindergartners, we now know that 1, they don't know what grams are, and 2, though most of these kids seem to really like candy, they only eat a few pieces a day and tend to only gorge themselves on holidays. That might not sound bad. But there are around 74 million kids in the U.S. alone, and the average American consumes about 24 pounds of candy every year. That means that 1,776 million pounds of candy a year is eaten by kids alone. And if we added the adults into the equation, that would be an extra 6,072 million pounds a year. I know I've just listed off a whole lot of big numbers, but in all actuality, 24 pounds a year per person isn't all that much, and is a healthy amount if it's balanced right. The thing I'm trying to really get at here is even though that amount of candy might not be bad for someone's health, think of the fuel, the wrappers, the trash. Although people really like candy, it's not always great for the environment. For example, the wrappers that are made to be cheap are almost always plastic, which is awful for the environment.
According to Lizzie O'Leary and Raghu Manavalan from Marketplace, we're only recycling about 25% of all plastic. That means that out of the 300 million tons of plastic that's thrown away each year, only 75 million tons are recycled at best. That's barely a third.
Candy is bad for the environment. For example, according to the WWF,
cultivation and processing of sugar produce environmental impacts through the loss of natural habitats, intensive use of water, heavy use of agrochemicals, and discharge and runoff of polluted effluent and air pollution. This leads to the degradation of wildlife, soil, air, and water where sugar is produced, and of downstream ecosystems. And the National Center for Biotechnology also states that 241 kilograms of carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere per each ton of sugar produced. The major part of the total emission, 44%, resulted from residues burning, about 20% resulted from the use of synthetic fertilizers, and about 18% from fossil fuel combustion. But it's not just the sugar in candy that's bad, it's the wrappers too. As the Plastic Pollution Coalition explains in an article that says new studies show plastic waste in the guts of fish we consume. And research shows that not only are fish eating plastic, they're also absorbing the toxins in the plastic, plus toxins they attract from surrounding waters. These same petrochemicals are found in humans, probably both from our poisoned food chain and from plastic packaging that poisons our food directly. But even though there are a lot of things wrong with candy production and waste, there's still a lot that can be done to help. Like switching to a green harvest system, which means harvesting without burning, and investment in appropriate irrigation infrastructure, which would reduce the emissions and pollution that the process of growing sugar produces. The problem of wrappers in oceans will also be helped if we urge companies to start wrapping their candy in more recyclable materials to help reduce plastic pollution. Because if you get enough people to stand up for what they believe in, others will listen, and that's where there can be change for the better.
Our third and final group today produced the podcast Consider the Vegan. Why don't we go around and get the names, your names, for our listeners, starting with you, Chris.
Hi, I'm Chris. I was the host in Consider the Vegan.
I was Carver, and I was a researcher.
My name is Alima, and I was the co-producer.
My name is Halen, and I was the editor.
And you were a participant.
Yes.
You were interviewed.
I was also interviewed.
Okay. And
Serena, and I was the other co-producer.
Oh, great. Now, in your podcast, you investigate the benefits of eating vegan, both personal and planetary. It seems a perfect topic for an assignment on globalization and food. Was that something you arrived at soon after you started brainstorming as a group? Chris, we'll let you as the spokesperson answer.
Yeah, I guess. It was kind of hard at first for us to figure out an idea, but once we got our idea, then we were good to go on everything.
Was Halen instrumental in that, since he's a vegan?
Yes, Halen helped us come up with the ideas.
Now, one interesting thing here, you did a lot of research. So you mentioned in the podcast that there's 1.6 million people in the U.S. who are vegan. Now, sometimes it seems, to me at least, that 1.5 million of them live in Portland. That's just surrounded by vegans. You also mentioned that Portland was named the most vegan-friendly city in the country by PETA, which is an animal rights group. So I'm guessing you had no problem, besides Halen, finding vegans for the podcast.
Yeah, it wasn't a problem at all. We interviewed Halen's mom, and we also interviewed a vegan restaurant in the podcast, and it was pretty cool.
So I just wanted to go down the list here. Christy Hawkins and her two kids. You're Christy. Oh wow! So so Christy's in here too. She helped drive the students over, but she was interviewed in there. Dylan, since Christy's not in front of a mic, did you want to talk a little bit about her reasons for going vegan?
Well, I think one of the reasons she went vegan is because it was more of a dietary choice. I think she wanted to go vegan for health reasons, mostly.
Then we had Dylan Powell, who's in your class, and she was in the Candy Calamity podcast. She's a vegan student there at Cottonwood. She mentioned that she also went vegan because of health reasons. She saw some kind of documentary on Netflix.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was that kind of a common thread among the vegans that you talked with? It was mostly for their personal health?
No, some of them did it for personal health, but others did it for more like animal rights.
So in addition to the health benefits of eating vegan, there's also some positive impact on the environment. I wonder, Chris, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, some of the positive impacts on the environment is when farms, like, I don't know how to explain it. Maybe Alima can explain it.
Alima, did you want to give it a try? Okay.
So when you have lots of cows in a farm, they are just eating a bunch, getting fat, and they fart and burp a lot, which produces methane, which is a greenhouse gas.
You have all these great podcasting skills after doing this. You learned quite a bit here about podcasting. Do any of you plan to continue, maybe do another podcast or do something with audio storytelling?
Maybe. I'm not sure if I like want to do it, but I might do it in the future.
Yeah, me too. It seems pretty fun and seems like something I might want to pursue.
Yeah, I was the editor, and I just like editing video and sound, and I'm going to probably use it in other things as well.
Yeah, great skill to learn. I'm still learning. There's a lot to it. But thanks very much for coming into KBOO today and for that wonderful podcast on Consider the Vegan.
I'm making a stand against the way animals are treated.
You think of food in America, chances are you think of something meat or animal product related. But not everyone in the U.S. eats those things. According to a study by the Vegan Bits website, about 1.6 million people in America are vegan, which may seem like a lot, but that's only 0.5% of the population. So, what motivates these 1.6 million people to give up meat and animal products? And what are the challenges and benefits to doing so? This is Chris Hayes in Consider the Vegan, and I will be investigating why people decide to go vegan. Christy Hawkins has been a vegan for 23 years. 11 of those years were spent in Portland raising two kids who are also vegan. We talked to her about the reasons she made that dietary choice and impacts of doing so. All right. Hi, I'm Chris. This is Serena, Alima, and Carver. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, my name is Christy Hawkins.
Okay. First things first, how are you today?
Doing great.
That's good. What made you decide that you wanted to be vegan?
Going vegan was a choice that I made over a long period of time. Reason being mostly animal rights to begin with. But then as I learned more about the health aspects of it and later environmental aspects, that just sort of kept me on that path and excited about the choice that I made.
What are the health aspects of being vegan?
If you do it right, as with any diet, you can do it wrong. With being vegan, it's just eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. They're, you know, a staple. The meals are overall less acidic. There's been a lot of studies that have shown people with vegetarian and vegan diets have less cancer and other diseases, obesity, heart disease, stuff like that, because of the high intake of fruits, vegetables, fibers, and non-fatty foods of meat.
What, like, foods do you use to get your protein?
I eat a lot of beans and nuts, tofu. Protein is in everything, really. And so I think that there's a pretty big misunderstanding that you need meat to get protein in America and maybe the world. But the amounts that are recommended in the commercial world are sort of overblown. And it's not really as necessary to get as much protein as they say. So I don't really even worry about protein.
How long have you been vegan for?
I went vegan in 1996.
Ooh.
So 23 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Dylan Powell, an eighth grader at the Cottonwood School of Civics and Science, has been vegan for a year. She is super passionate about being vegan and was able to give us some more insight on why people may choose to go vegan, especially the animal rights portion of it. Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Okay. Why did you become vegan?
Well, it sort of started with, so there's this documentary on Netflix, I can't remember what it was called, but it was talking about, like, how animals were treated, and it pretty much just talked about how bad chickens' conditions are, and it brought to light a lot of the dark side of, like, the meat and dairy industry.
Yeah.
I'm making a stand against the way animals are treated, I guess.
What are some benefits of being vegan?
Well, I'm not going to say necessarily it's like, oh my gosh, that's the healthiest, but it pushes you to be healthy. Like, you can be healthy while still eating meat and stuff. You can be vegan and eat bread and pasta and just, like, vegan pizza all day, all night. But you gotta be sure you get enough vitamins, because I'm blood type O, and that they need a lot of protein and stuff. But ever since I've been vegan, sometimes I need to take these pills to make sure my protein is up, or else I'll get anemic and I get bruises really easily. So it can be bad in some ways for certain people, but overall it is healthier because it pushes you to, like, eat fruits and vegetables and be conscious about what you're eating.
Vivi Moss is a vegan and an employee at Oracle, a vegan coffee shop in Portland.
Do you know how they decided to be a vegan coffee shop?
So the owners, they combined, have been vegan for over 60 years, I think. And so it's just, we all want to serve a product that we can get behind. I'm vegan myself, and it's like, if we can't, like, taste a milk to, like, know how it tastes, to, like, know if it's, like, good to serve or something like that, you know, we just can't stand behind, you know, something that we ourselves don't drink.
Why did you decide to be vegan?
There are just a plethora of reasons. So when I actually grew up in Texas, like, very traditional family, very, like, hamburgers and steak and things like that. And I was born with, like a rare genetic disease, and that makes my esophagus, like, super narrow, and then it totally closed up when I was in high school. I had to have it dilated 5 times so I could even, like, swallow my own spit. Growing up to, like, the stock show and the rodeo with my family, like, seeing the animals, like, in their, like, little tiny compartments, and then, like, seeing my granddad would, like, make jokes about how that's what he's having for dinner and stuff like that, and I just, like, my heart was broken, and I, like, knew, like, from a young age, I was like, I want to be a vegetarian. It's like, I knew I wanted to be a vegetarian for sure. And so then I moved up to Oregon when I was 20, and became a vegetarian shortly after that. And then a few years later, milk started to, like, make me sick. And so, and it was, like, kind of a long time coming anyway, you know? And I was like, yeah, this is gross. I just need to, like, cut out the milk and eggs. And it's just, like, you just feel, like, less slimy. You know what I mean? You just, like, you feel so much better. And then it's also, like, yeah, you just, once you do it, I feel like you only regret, like, not doing it sooner, you know? So that was kind of my own journey. And so it's been like 10 years now. Yeah.
Awesome.
Halen Harrison, a 7th grader, has been vegan his whole life.
Hello, my name is Chris, and today we are interviewing a very special boy. His name is...
Halen.
So, Halen, how long have you been vegan for?
My whole life, which is 13 years.
Why did you become vegan?
I just kind of have always been vegan. I never really chose to be vegan or not to be vegan. I just grew up being vegan, and then I just never said, I don't want to be vegan anymore.
Do you have a choice to be vegan?
I do. My parents don't make me be vegan.
So why do you choose to be vegan?
I don't know. I guess it's just because I've been vegan my whole life, and I don't really feel like changing that.
What are some challenges of being vegan?
Just not being able to eat some things, like at parties.
What are some benefits of being vegan?
It is pretty healthy if you do it right.
How do you get your protein?
Beans, mostly. Soybeans, especially.
Is it hard to find restaurants that serve vegan food?
When I'm traveling, yes, but here in Portland, not really. A lot of places have options.
And what's your favorite restaurant to go to?
Los Gorditos. It's a Mexican restaurant. They're not an all-vegan restaurant. It's just they have a vegan menu.
How do you feel about the meat/dairy industry?
I don't really care what other people eat. I'm not saying, like, you're a monster for eating this. I just want to be vegan. I don't care if other people want to or don't want to be vegan.
There are many vegan restaurants in Portland, and an article by PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, found Portland to be the most vegan-friendly city in the country due to its many vegan restaurants and its large vegan population. According to the Healthline website, vegan diets, because they are often consistent of more fruits and vegetables, can help you lose weight, improve kidney functions, lower blood sugar, and even protect against some cancers. A study by Faunalytics on the website VeganBits has found that around 70% of people who are vegan decide to go vegan based on either health or animal right reasons. But there are a lot of other reasons as well, including it being good for the climate. In fact, going vegan is one of the most effective things an individual can do to lower their carbon footprint. The people we interviewed tended to have gone vegan because of animal rights, but they are just a sampling of the 1.6 million vegans out there, and everyone has their own reason for the choices they make. This is Chris Hayes in Consider the Vegan. Bye.
We've been talking with a group of 7th and 8th grade students from Portland's Cottonwood School of Civics and Science and their humanities teacher, Emily Connor. The students recently completed podcasts on the topic globalization and food and entered them in the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Emily and her students for talking with us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.